Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire.
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel, we are energizing transporter beam. Now.
Hello, welcome everyone to Star Trek From the Holodeck. This is the Starfleet Academy edition. So the episode titled Come Let's Away. It feels like it's a line crossing moment for the series. At least that's what I had originally put in our show notes until I watched ahead and watched the next episode.
Yes.
So I don't know if that's largely true. Now, just to be completely transparent with the listeners, David, we are delayed in recording.
We are.
So we have watched episode 6 and episode 7. When I had watched episode 6, I was far more excited.
I was like,
okay, this is the series I've been waiting for. We have finally crossed that line. And I'll leave it there as our next discussion will tackle the issues of episode 7.
Yes.
What we got in this episode was something that far exceeds the innocent foundations of Starfleet Academy and crosses into the maturity of real world issues, into hostage horror, if you will.
Yes.
You know, moral compromise. And there was actual real loss, and not symbolic lost. It's real loss.
Real loss.
There was no lesson of the week. It was people die, you know, cadets die, mentors die, and the Federation makes decisions that can't be hand-waved away by optimism or protocol. This episode was fast. It was tense and surprisingly unsentimental. It doesn't pause to reassure audiences that everything is going to be okay. And it doesn't let the characters stay safely within the boundaries of students. Because yes. By the end, these cadets or kids aren't cadets in training anymore. They're survivors of something much larger than themselves. There are real stakes, which has been my problem with this show. Now, people may think, David, that I don't have problems with this show because of the way we talk. But something people need to understand, we are not and will never be simply trolls. We give shows a fair shake. And if you listen carefully, you can hear within our show the subtext.
Yeah.
We are breaking down things that the episode's doing. That doesn't mean bad or good. So when we talk about the philosophy or the themes, we're telling you what the episode is doing. And if you listen carefully, we don't usually put values on it. Sometimes we'll say this part was really good or this part wasn't that great, but we're not putting those subjective goods and bads. What we do is we break down and we discuss. And if you look at our ratings more or less gives you the traditional bad / good review that people are more familiar with. So when I say I'm enjoying the series, I'm enjoying it to an extent. I feel like there are through lines here that feel like Star Trek. There are certain themes they're touching on that are, in fact, Star Trek themes. But overall, the show it doesn't feel overall like Star Trek at times. Mm-hmm. However, this episode here does make me or give me some hope that the writers understand what Star Trek needs to be. But I think ultimately that's why I enjoy this episode is there was that emotion, right, David? There was that sense of loss, the sense of grief, but there was sacrifice. There was maturity. There was understanding. And ultimately the episode stood on those strengths.
Well, there were stakes. There were actual stakes involved in this. And it's not. The problem that I do walk away with, in particular with this episode, is like What Starfleet Academy truly needs is a true, honest-to-God villain. Because that's what Braca is. And to not have him being around the whole time, I think, is a detriment to the series.
Yeah, that, honestly, if you had to point to one big mistake, well, there's a couple here, but it's the lack of use and total squander of Paul Giamatti.
Especially that ending.
How has he been in only two episodes?
He's been two. Think about this, Mike. He's been in two episodes. And I thought about this with Braca. He's been in two episodes. And we have a complete understanding of this character. And he's not a shallow villain. Like, in all the scenes that Braca's in, every single moment has made that character flourish. To the very end of this episode, where my favorite moment is when he tells Aki, I hate you because you think your way of life is better than mine.
Yeah.
And I'm like going, okay, sweet. We get to actually see the motivations of a villain.
Yeah. And we can understand that.
Yeah.
That's an ideology or a sentiment that I think most can understand. Because I think that's the most important thing when it comes to shows like this. You got to have a villain that we can get, that we can understand, which I think is its strength of the series so far. And unfortunately, they're just not using that strength to its fullest potential. Now, there's another thing that I'm finding that I have some issues with when it comes to this series, Dave. The show shows little interest in lingering over technobabble. Now, I'm not the biggest fan of technobabble. However, if you are a longtime Star Trek viewer, you understand that the writers have always gone to great lengths to explain the science, the fringe science, the pseudoscience, whatever it may be. There's usually a real understanding of the science itself and an explanation of the science in the show. Here we are again with Starfleet Academy. This happened in Picard season one, where they had magical devices that you just had to use your imagination and it would repair a fucking ship.
Yeah.
Like, one of the worst things ever put into Star Trek was, oh my God, I was angry. Picard season one had so many fucking issues.
Yeah.
And here we are again with a lot of those types of things. For example, we're left to infer how certain things function. Tarima's abilities. We need to kind of understand exactly what's going on with that. How is a device on her neck inhibiting emotion? Like, how does that work? Neurologically, I'm assuming, okay, let's explain it. Sonic weapons operating in space. How does that work? Or even the precise nature of Sam and her vulnerabilities. How is she getting hurt from phaser fire?
Mm-hmm.
We, as Star Trek fans, can fill it in because we understand emitters. But where's the emitter? We understand the damaging of holographic emitters. Okay, but where are the emitters? They've never explained still how holographic images are just around.
Yes.
And I'm not just talking about characters. I'm also talking about the way they communicate now.
Oh, yeah.
How does that happen? I think Discovery Season 2, when Pike entered the equation, they quickly explained certain things, but they focused on explaining why the Enterprise was never shown to have this technology. And yes. Pike was almost like a Luddite, where he was like, well, I ripped out all that stuff out of the Enterprise, and that will never be in our ships.
In our ships.
So that's how they fixed it in terms of canon. But still, the technology itself has not been explained. And I'm not one of those I call them technology babies in Star Trek that needs everything explained. But when you start throwing more and more and more things without explanations, it just becomes lazy writing. And Star Trek has never been lazy in explaining things.
Star Trek has never made it a habit of making the audience figure it out. That's the thing. Is like, there would be something that at least the Star Trek writers would throw in there to kind of open up the discussion. Can this technology work? Yes, this, you know, can you have holograms actually walking around us? Technically, yes, you could. And they did express that in like old episodes of Voyager. At least with the Doctor, they explained the emitter.
Yeah. But how does the doctor get by now?
Exactly.
Is it because it's part of the communication technologies now? Since that technology is available, then obviously there's no issues with the hologram. But also that technology has been around since the Discovery era now.
Exactly.
Which is the original series era, give or take a decade or so. So there's a lot of fuckery going on with the technology, and they really got to fucking like simmer down with it.
They got to tighten it up. They honestly really have to.
Yes.
I mean, I'm
still waiting for them to explain. This is something we talked about during our Discovery coverage. The personal transporters are cool.
Yes.
But we already know all of the ins and outs of transporter technology. Because it's one of those mainstays. It's one of the most iconic. Right after Spock and Kirk, Beam Me Up is a massive pop culture saying and icon. So we all know this idea of the transporter. So it's been browbeaten into many people. We understand how it works. There's been countless episodes describing how it works. Whereas with the personal transporters, we're still left to wonder, how does it work when you need pattern buffers?
Yes.
And it seems like it's endless in its ability to just do whatever. How do they know where they're going? Is there some type of neural link? Because they never say, take me to the bridge.
Yeah.
They just go.
It
doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I don't want to be overly nitpicky, but I'm trying to express some of the problems that are prevalent in this series.
Well, even with this particular episode, and then later on with when we cover the next episode, the problem that I'm seeing is like a lot of the Star Trek writers are doing something with the technology because in their brain, it sounds cool. And I can see that. And that to me is a really bad omen when you actually can see the inner workings of a writer when you see something on, particularly with Starfleet Academy, it looks pretty. But there's nothing behind it. It's cool to know that, you know, there's this species that's all based on machinery, and they send this AI hologram Sam all the way here to study us.
AI hologram Sam.
Yeah. And I enjoyed the episode with Sam, but I said at the end of this, they have to explain how her technology works.
Yeah, they're not, Dave.
And yeah,
they're not.
And now I'm like going, oh my God, they're not. They're really not going to actually explain any of this. And it leaves it open to simple writing errors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so let's break down why this episode works, because it doesn't sound like we liked it, but we did. Probably the strongest episode of the season to date. But I do feel like this is the clearest articulation yet of what Starfleet Academy actually wants to be. At least what we hope it wants to be.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed. So what immediately stands out about this episode is how little breathing room it gives you, thankfully. Because of those stakes that we were mentioning, there's no leisurely A plot or B plot rhythm. Everything is escalation. The structure itself mirrors the experience of the cadets. Once things go wrong, they never really stop going wrong.
Yeah. And I think I really like that it started toward the very beginning with what happened to, I think it's their quote unquote red shirt captain, which was Tomoff.
Mentor, yeah.
Yeah, their mentor. I was like, holy shit, he actually got killed. And he got killed brutally. I'm sorry, getting eaten? That's brutal.
I definitely would have sacrificed myself for those rugrats.
You'd be like pushing them at
those unappreciative little shits.
I'm going to get eaten.
One of them's not even real. It's a hologram.
Exactly. Mike, here was what I was thinking. And this is how my brain works. I'm like, why is Sam worried?
I don't know.
She's not going to get eaten.
I know.
She's a freaking hologram. You know what I would have done? I would have told Sam, stay out there.
Yeah.
Stay out there. You're fine. Have we not remembered First Contact when the doctor actually gets confronted by the Borg?
No. You're going way back. I'm talking two episodes ago. Yeah. When Sam and her team were fighting against
the War College.
The War College. And the blaster fire was able to go through her. So what are you afraid of?
What are you afraid of?
You're not real.
And that's why I would literally, because that's why I kept thinking to myself, is like, wait a minute, why is Sam panicking? If I was on that team, I'd say, Sam, stay out there. You're fine. They're not going to eat you because they can't touch you.
Now, we know that photonics can be distorted and damaged with phasers, but that was also because there were emitters on the doctor, and there were also emitters in the holodeck itself that you can disrupt. But this is an untethered being.
Yeah.
So... All right, let's just move on.
See the logic?
Yeah. So action is at least is moving forward.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of character-driven moments. These are the types of character-driven aspects Star Trek is more comfortable with, in my opinion, where you raise the stakes. They have to learn through actual experience. They have to survive through teamwork. And also, not just teamwork, but they have to survive through either learning or finally understanding Starfleet and Federation ideals. And that was the strength of this episode. When you have someone like Caleb talking shit once again about Starfleet and saying that comic book, whatever it was titled, which is a spin on the actual pulp magazine from back in the day about the West.
Yeah.
Which is largely considered amongst academic circles. I've actually studied this with
Tales
people.
From the Frontier, it's called.
That it's a way to excuse, what's it called, David? The
Manifest Destiny?
Manifest Destiny, yes. It's the glorification and justification of Manifest Destiny. So I understood the allegory there, and it definitely worked. And by the end of the episode, I loved how Caleb's entire perspective on Starfleet basically changed because, A, he questioned and was surprised that their mentor was willing to die for them. That was the moment where he finally saw why Starfleet and the Federation stands tall.
Yes.
And why so many believe in them. Something that he viewed negatively, he now is starting to see those positive aspects. And then when Bavi,
yes,
the Vulcan War College cadet, jumped in the way of phaser fire and died, that was the final moment where Caleb finally understood what Starfleet stands for.
Yes. And it's not about military might or anything, or the difference between the Starfleet cadets and the War College. It's actually a mindset of being Starfleet.
It's the protection of life at all costs.
It's the protection of life at all cost. And that's what I really liked about the core of this story, was seeing Caleb come to understand that Starfleet's not just about, you know, the telltale to boldly go out and seek out strange new lives and all that jazz. There is actually something that I really like about how they kind of bring back the idea that a lot of, like, the later Star Trek series kind of brought out, that being in Starfleet means you make that choice to go out there, to actually take that gamble. You have to do this to, in order to attain enlightenment, sometimes you have to make a sacrifice. And it takes that to actually get us there. You know, Enterprise did that, I thought, brilliantly, showing that there's a price for enlightenment. There's a price for progress.
Yeah.
And here, this episode, I think, got it really well with this character of Caleb, who really started this series jaded. And now, by the end of this, now we can actually see that Caleb has the makings of a Starfleet cadet because he's understanding now. And in hindsight, when it first happened, I thought it was really strange that, so they're all going to trust Baraka of all people to help them, but Starfleet's willing to work with those that they do not get along well with.
It's about bridging those communication gaps, right?
And sometimes, yeah, you have to work with people you do not like. And that's what I actually really dug too, throwing that in there, because at first I thought it was weird that Vance basically says, yeah, let's bring in Baraka to help. And I'm like, Vance, are you sure about this? But then when you actually take a look at the whole story and what it's trying to say, it makes sense. Starfleet is about not...
Well, that those choices, and this is why this episode is the strength of the season so far. That was a rational choice. It was not an emotional choice. Vance made a rational decision. That is what we're all comfortable with and familiar with when we watch Star Trek. I mean, how many times during TNG did Picard rebuke someone for an overly emotional consensus or thought? In fact, there was an episode where Data, air quotes, was getting emotional when he was trying to save that girl from a dying planet, and he was coming dangerously close to breaking the prime directive. And when Picard was in his writing room with his team, he was giving them all chances to sell him on why they should ignore the prime directive and save this girl. And every single one of their reasons were emotional, and Picard ended it and said, that's all sophistry.
Yes.
So having Vance be the adult literally in the room and revert to rational thought over emotion is the reason why this episode is so strong, because it's resting on traditional Star Trek foundations.
Yeah.
All right. So we have the USS Miyazaki, which was a really good choice of setting because they already gave, before the episode even begins, they already gave us this feeling of death.
Of dread.
Of doom. Yes, of dread. You know, a ship destroyed after the burn, frozen in time, filled with ghosts, both literal and digital.
Yes.
And the moment the Furies, not the Furies, that would change it up.
It would have made it a little bit more pleasant.
The shippers might have had a field day.
There you go.
The Furies arrive. The genre then shifts into more, I would say, the horrific, a little bit of a horror vibe, because you have these characters. I mean, these villains, they eat human flesh.
Yes.
And I believe they were described as bats.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, because they, I think they had some kind of echolocation or something.
Yeah. See, so one thing the Kurtzman era gets right consistently, whenever they decide to design new aliens, they do it very well. Look at the co-species on Saru's home planet, Kaminar, right? Is that what it was?
Kaminar.
I always forget the name of the predator species. Well, actually, they were a prey species, right? And then...
Yeah, and then they turned into a predator species.
I forgot their name.
I'm going to look it up.
Gabul or...
Is it the Bool?
No. Baul.
Baul.
Baul. Yeah, yeah. So it's just like with the Baul, which, dude, every time I rewatch Discovery and I get to that episode where we see the Baul for the first time, I'm fucking blown away.
Yes.
The mixture of practical and CGI is just spot on with that design. And here we are again with the Furies, equally designed very well. I mean, cannibalistic. Like threats, right?
Oh my God, yes.
That's something that's terrifying.
That is terrifying. And that's the thing that I really liked about it, was like, it's something that me and you have discussed that in the past episodes that we keep harping about, is like, there's no stakes that we feel. There's no tension. You know, a good show has drama. It has tension. And Starfleet Academy kind of, you know, tries to take it easy, be kid friendly. as it were. And then we get to this episode where, oh no, we're not kid friendly anymore. We're going to watch people get eaten and then get jettisoned out of the ship and their body floats in space. And I'm like going, oh, okay, cool. Cool. Thank you.
Yeah. The maturity of this episode was definitely on point. They threw out the overly affect feelings that we have been given so far. The emotional that has just doused all of the narratives of this series so far. At least they threw that out the window. It becomes more traumatic. Something that it seems like this Star Trek is running away from in terms of having real danger for these cadets, and possibly because they're children and maybe people don't have appetites to see cadets getting killed. But here we are. They did it. And the show has improved because of it.
Yeah.
Bringing Nuss Braca on board the show, I should say, again, after fucking 6 episodes, it raises the stakes. His unpredictability is what brings or helps aids in the stakes. You don't know where he's, well, now you do. By the end of the episode, you understand him and you understand where he stands as a threat. But up to this point, you're not quite sure what to expect from him. And that's why when you throw him in this episode, it works so well.
And he, in this episode, it really elevates the character of Aki too, because now we have a perfect foil for her. Braca is the perfect foil. Like when you think about, like, when people always throw around discussions about, oh, heroes and their villains, you know, you have Kirk and Khan, you have Picard and the Borg, Data and Lore. Aki and
Riker,
Braca.
Angelico.
But with Aki and Braca, it's actually really cool because now we get to not only have these really two rivals, but they also represent kind of two ways of thinking. You have the Starfleet way of Aki thinking, but then you have the type of feeling that people who are jaded towards the Federation in Braca.
Yeah. And that is something that has been a problem area for a lot of Star Trek fans, because that's something that I would say is a big part of Kurtzman era Star Trek. Not that they are throwing the middle finger at Star Trek and Starfleet, but seemingly at times it does seem that way. But what they're doing, and we had these discussions during our Discovery coverage, oftentimes in order to prove that something works, you must deconstruct it and rebuild it again to prove that it does work. And that's why a saying like, I hate you because you think your way of life is better than mine, is incredibly powerful, because it's showing a view that will ultimately be shunned by the end of the show. And largely, it was done in this episode. You have Braca, who probably mirrors a lot of how Caleb feels. So you have the two of them with those ideas. And what does this episode do? It literally goes to lengths to prove they're both wrong. Caleb as well as Nuss Braca. So there's nothing wrong with exposing potential problems with something. We're dealing with a post-Burn society, which is, I've said this for a very long time, I love the Burn, because the Burn serves that as that historical point that we can all relate to at this moment in our own contemporary lives in the real world, where we feel disillusioned.
Yes.
Having these people bring those ideas up and then tackling them immediately is a very powerful way to do Star Trek. Because when Braca says, I hate you, it's not about power. It's about legitimacy. He doesn't want to destroy the Federation, although I'm sure he would be just fine with it being destroyed. He wants to expose it.
Yeah. It's very similar to how they reintroduced Mudd in Strange New Worlds. Mudd is like this character now that basically is very jaded towards the Federation. I think it was in Strange New Worlds, or it was in Discovery when they reintroduced Mudd, Harry Mudd. But like, that was the sentiment that I actually started really liking, is like, you can't expect everyone in the universe to be gung-ho with the Federation. You just can't. And that's why bringing it to the forefront here with Braca, I think, was really cool, because they took a concept that, you know, Star Trek the last couple of years and then a couple of the Kurtzman series, they tiptoe around this because they know it's a dangerous thing to say. Because we as Star Trek fans are going, no, everyone gets along well in Star Trek. That's the whole point. That's why.
Well, the crews, right?
Yeah. And now we're seeing that sentiment that people are finally starting to get the idea that it's not the fact that you have the crews arguing among themselves. It's the things outside.
Yeah.
It's the non-Federation things that we now understand. Okay. People can actually have their own opinion.
Listen, you know what? No one is divine in the world of Star Trek necessarily. So nothing's going to be perfect. So the Federation and Starfleet is an ideal. It's an ideal. And something changed in humanity. That's the whole point. The whole idea of Star Trek is that there was something, there was a switch where we changed. Humanity changed, and they largely changed. Doesn't mean there aren't a few, you know, cavemen still running around doing stupid shit.
Yes.
In fact, we've seen numerous people throughout the years in Star Trek who don't really fit the
mold,
the progressive ideals, you know, the growth of humanity. So it's not that humanity is perfect. They have just realized that there needs to be a change. It's much like what happened during the Enlightened. A lot of people and academics, historians, scholars have always tried to really tackle, like, what really happened during the Enlightenment? Why did we go from believing in the mystical to something more grounded like science?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we went from just accepting answers to wanting to understand those answers. And what they have now come to terms with is that there was something that changed at that time in history. During the Enlightenment, there was something in our brains that changed. And rather than just taking myth and saying, yeah, I believe that, we decided to say, no. There's got to be an explanation. Yes. There's got to be a reason why we see certain things, why we believe certain things. So our brains changed the way we view life and the questions we had. And largely, that's how Star Trek functions. It's almost like a second enlightenment. Something changed. We realized that all of these superficialities, all of our desires and wants of the superficial and the material, it didn't matter. Look where it got us. It got us to World War III, the near brink extinction of humanity. So our way of thinking changed. Our cognitive faculties changed, and it became more teleological, aiming towards greatness and constant improvement. But that does not mean that everybody is going to think that way. You're going to have those outliers,
yes,
those people. So again, bringing it back to Star Trek, when you have people that make mistakes, people like Caleb that doesn't like Starfleet, or even how the show started, David, where we had that moment where Aki chose to take Caleb from his mother. They're human.
Yeah.
People make human mistakes. That's the point. It's not that Starfleet failed. It's not that the Federation failed. It's that, hey, people are still people. They're not perfect.
Yeah. And that's the thing that basically I like, you know, on the flip side with this episode is, like, we, in the very beginning, we saw the mistakes of being human, of making those human errors. But here, this is what the consequences, you truly get this idea that basically these are the consequences of making those mistakes. People get hurt. And that in itself is, like, I think one of the easiest way as a writer you can convey that easily in your story is, like, show your consequences. Your characters will learn if you make the consequences that dire.
Look at the Maquis.
Yeah.
Introduced in TNG and took more firm root in, narratively speaking, in Deep Space Nine. It wasn't. This rise of this terrorist group wasn't because the Federation necessarily failed. It was because of the limits of their power and control. It was politics and government. The desire for peace with another species is what opened the doorway for this disgruntlement. So it's not necessarily Starfleet. It's humanity still imperfect.
Yeah.
And we can't control all things. Or I should say the humans in this show can't control all things. So I do feel like this episode really worked in line with those types of thoughts. This episode felt more like Discovery's approach to Star Trek. And for the most part, it definitely worked.
Yeah. This honestly is my favorite episode because like it feels like we finally got somewhere with Starfleet Academy. I mean, up to this point, it just feels like, okay, let's have another safe episode. Let's have an episode on, you know, this moral stance. Here, it's more about the narrative. It's more about the story, which to me is more important. You started this series wanting us to care about Caleb. After this episode, now I see the steps that we've seen to make us care more, to actually root for him.
Another thing this episode is doing pretty well, and I would even say Starfleet Academy is doing fairly well, is exploring the post-Burn world. That's something that you and I had wanted for Deep Space, or not Deep Space Nine, for Discovery.
For Discovery.
We had hoped that they fleshed out the universe post-Burn. Like, what is it like? Where are all these species? What's going on? What has happened when, or what happens when the Federation dissolves essentially and Starfleet shrinks? We saw some of that, but mostly the things that we saw were important to our crew, the Discovery crew. So there wasn't room to fully explore other avenues. This series is going to great length, and I do appreciate that, to explore the post-Burn world. So rather than giving us exposition dumps where you have characters just talk in a derivative fashion explaining things, the episode actually shows us the state of the galaxy through necessity. You know, the Federation isn't weak, but it's no longer central. You have pirates and middlemen that are in control of certain areas of space. Moral compromises are structural, not exceptional. And stories and myths replace stable historical continuity. So we are finally being exposed to what the Burn really did.
Yes. It wasn't just the cry of a child.
No, it just oh my God. How dare you bring that up? I was trying not to say that.
I'm sorry. It's just stuck in my brain, especially when you get to Sukal.
But I will say, David, that I don't have a problem with this notion of a fractured galaxy, because what it does, if done correctly, they haven't quite gone in this direction fully yet, but it allows other shows to do so under different leadership, perhaps. I don't agree with this thought, but there are a lot of Star Trek fans, as well as Star Trek academics and scholars, that have said, well, where do you go once the utopia has been reached? That was, I don't want to say the complaint, but that was part of the discussion with TNG. Well, this is the utopia. The original series was...
It was the beginning.
Yes. Then TNG was kind of the end of that. This is the utopia. It's a post-scarcity world, or post-scarce world. You have the food replicators. So there was a lot of discussion, like, where do you go? Well, that's why they came up with Deep Space Nine, because Deep Space Nine wasn't necessarily about the utopia. It was more about, okay, here we are. We're in the utopia, and now we're going to bring others in. Bajor. Yeah. While also working as a buffer between a potential occupying force and the species we hope to bring into our utopia, the people we hope to bring into our utopia.
Yeah.
Voyager, also working within those same confines, chose to do a show that was essentially lost in space. And that's the reason why. It's because what do you do now? We've already shown the utopia. So the next step was going back in time, dealing with uncharted territory. That's why they did Enterprise. You had an excuse to show
the beginnings,
the struggle, imperfections still, things that weren't quite right that we know were eventually straightened out and fixed because of the stories told in TNG and Deep Space Nine. Then you have Discovery. Discovery was working in the original series territory for the most part, and then it chose to jump forward. And when it jumped forward, how do you jump forward to stories that are going to be filled with stakes when you just jump further into an even better utopia?
Yes.
That's why you introduced the burn. The burn, for a lot of, I know a lot of people hated it, but the reason for it is narratively sound. It not only can you use it to tell stories that are relevant in today's climate, in our own social realities and cultural realities, but also it allows the show to be adventurous again,
yeah,
to have mystery, to give us a bit of an underdog story, because if the Federation's always on top, then it doesn't have a lot of stakes.
Yeah, it helps reset the board, basically.
There you go, David.
It helps reset the board when it comes to your story narrative, because not only that, what do you do when you've lost the utopia? Okay, there's a really good question. You gain the utopia. What happens if you lose it? Yeah. Is it a complete cycle all over again? Do you learn from your past mistakes? And that's what I thought we were going to really see, what Kurtzman was going to really show, is like the utopia is still possible. It's still possible, but it's about now learning from that mistake, learning that basically, hey, we need to be more open. We need to be more diplomatic than ever. We have to bring in these new species so that the Federation can actually grow again. You know, you can't rely on just Klingons and Romulans and that. You have to bring in the other alien species and some that basically you may not really think are safe.
All right, so final thoughts. Definitely a turning point episode. This episode, I think, tells us the show's ambitions are real. At least we can hope.
We can hope.
It doesn't necessarily retreat from its consequences, and it doesn't reset at the end. This is also probably the strongest ensemble acting of the season.
Yes.
Stakes now feel cumulative or serial. Braca positioned as a long game antagonist. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Fingers crossed.
And it sets expectations higher for the final arc. The episode isn't just about the cadets growing up. It's about Star Trek remembering that optimism only matters when it's tested. I give this episode an 80%.
I'm with you there. I'm actually at a 82 with this episode because I really did enjoy it. I mean, having Holly Hunter and Paul Giamatti play opposite each other is just fun. And when I noticed that when both of those actors are on screen, I'm glued to my seat. And it helps me actually retain what else is going on with the other characters. It makes me care about Caleb. And even if, you know, Braca and Aki aren't on the same scene with Caleb, their narrative chemistry really carried the episode this time around. So it goes to what me and you said in a couple episodes ago, is like the biggest crime is the fact that we don't get Paul Giamatti more in this series, because he is a complete asset to this series.
Yeah. All right. Well, this brings us to the end of our discussion. I want to thank everybody for listening. If you want to get more of our discussions, you can go to patreon.com/Rainman Digital and pledge a dollar or more and gain access to Unimatrix Zero. It's our pre-show where we kind of get the poison out, talk about things that our longtime listeners understand. They don't always need the nuance to fully understand what we're talking about because they've been listening to us for years. So exactly. They don't get all angry at us and they understand us.
Yes.
So Thank you, David.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain?
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.